This is Michelle, and you're listening to Words with Michelle, the podcast, a show where I sit down and have conversations with influencers on a range of topics, anything from natural hair, employment, discrimination, food, relationships, and everything in between. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. If you want to send me an email, hit me up at michelle@wordsmichelle.com. Thanks for tuning into the latest episode of Words with Michelle, the podcast. As you may know, I'm not a parent, but I really wanted to do a show on education. It's funny because I received a phone call from a friend a couple weeks ago who suggested I speak with one of his friends regarding the topic of education. He didn't know at the time that that's what I was thinking about. So in this episode, I speak with his friend, Tiffany Anderson, a communicative disorders assistant, and she speaks about education and minority students with regards to the disproportionality of minority students in special education. It's a long title, but what it includes is the overrepresentation as well as the underrepresentation of minority students in special education. So if you're a parent and have questions regarding your child's performance in school, this show may be of interest to you. It's also of interest to anyone who wants to know what's happening in the classroom. So please welcome Tiffany to the show. I start the show asking Tiffany to provide a quick bio. So can you just give us a quick bio on yourself, Tiffany?
Yes. Thank you for having me. So my name is Tiffany Anderson. I am a communicative disorders assistant. I currently work for a children's rehabilitation center, working with a vast range of children with speech and language, as well as developmental disorders. And I also provide tutoring intervention for children with learning disabilities, specifically for children with autism. And I have just recently actually completed a master's in developmental psychology and education. And it's a long title, so I always get confused.
Congratulations, but, yeah. By the way. Congratulations. That sounds
Thank
awesome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You so much. Yeah. I've been working in this field for probably over 6 years, almost 7 years. And I love what I do. And I'm trying to make an impact in the community. And now my focus has kind of shifted to what I can do for my community to increase the awareness of special education and resources that support children in schools.
So this show was inspired by Tiffany's research paper, Disproportionality of Minority Students in Special Education. So I asked her why she researched a topic and what she found. So what were some of the findings that you found? What did you discover?
Right. So first of all, just to talk about what disproportionality is, that refers to decisions made about special education placements that result from the beliefs and practices that discriminate against a group of individuals. So for me, it was focused on minority children and how the system discriminates them in over and under representation in special education programs. And so I focused on the current research on this phenomenon of special education placement and how these programs either have an over-representation of kids in these programs or an under-representation of kids in these programs. And so the main findings of this research found that in regards to over-representation, children are often misdiagnosed and put into incorrect special education programs, and this creates a situation where the students face stigma and are in environments that deny them access to general education, which would help them to reach their potential. So it's a real issue. That's pretty much what I got from that research. And there is a consensus across the research that this is a phenomenon and something that happens every day, right? It's not a one-off, but it's a lot of children who are minorities specifically are being put into programs that do not showcase their actual ability. It actually undermines them and makes them lose confidence in their ability. And some of the factors that the research states of why this happens is because there's a lack of resources to support their learning. And so again, with this lack of resources, it creates an environment where you believe the child cannot learn, but it's because they don't have the proper tools to learn why they're not doing well. So, you know, the teacher will assume that they're not bright, they are struggling intellectually, or that there's some learning issue, but really it's the tools that we're using to measure these kids is a major contributor to this overrepresentation in these programs. Another big one that came up in the research was inequitable assessment tools for assessing behavior and academic skills. So one tool that we talked about when I was in my undergrad, and we talked about this, was some of the tools that they use do not represent cultural diversity, right? For some kids, you know, who do these assessments, they understand everything that's presented in front of them. But let's say a child from India comes to Canada and is given an assessment, and they're asked about baseball, and baseball is not something that they have any experience with, have ever been introduced to. Okay. They're going to be perceived as low intelligence because they don't know this, but it doesn't consider that it's not lack of intelligence, it's lack of awareness. And so in the same sense for Black children and for minority children, there are things on these assessments that they don't relate with or understand. And it's not a lack of intelligence, but a lack of exposure. And they are not used to certain things that are presented on these assessments.
What would be an example of that then? Like a Black child or a minority child wouldn't, like you gave baseball for you know, a child in India, but for a child that, like, say a child that was born in Canada, you know, maybe of Caribbean descent, what would you say would be a cultural bias?
Well, one of the biggest ones is the behavioral assessments, right? The way that a Caribbean person raises their child and the behaviors that they exhibit are different than a white person and their child and how they behave at home and what they understand to be appropriate behaviors. Mm-hmm. And sometimes behaviors seen in children who are Black are seen as more excessive, even if there's a child who is white that has the same behavior. Black children are still looked at as more aggressive, more behavioral. So it doesn't consider that bias in there is the big one. In terms of academics, for the most part, most children, you know, have the same opportunity in Canada, but then we have to consider children who come from lower socioeconomic status places where, for example, they don't have access to a lot of reading material, right? So then when they then do a reading assessment, their reading level is a lot poorer and they're put in reading programs with like really simplistic material, but it's only because they didn't have the exposure to it, right? More exposure to it would have increased their ability to read and they wouldn't need all that additional support. But at the same time, I don't think the assessment considers, you know, home environment, right? When they put them in these programs, and the programs are not always beneficial because, again, even if it's supporting reading skills, it also might make them feel less motivated to work because it makes them feel stupid. When they know they're not stupid, they need a challenge. They need more challenging material, but they're put in programs that don't challenge them because they're seen as less intelligent. So that's a big one that I've seen recently. And, you know, it's heartbreaking because I know they have so much potential.
Yeah. Like you said, like, I mean, if you're not being challenged and you don't want to be in class, you know what I mean? And then who knows what the next step would be, you know, either dropping out or whatever.
Just to add on, it creates a gap in their learning, right? Because when they don't want to learn, then they're missing, like they're ignoring, you know, the material that's in front of them. And then it creates a bigger gap. So like maybe they're at a grade 2 level and that gap just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And unfortunately, schools don't fail kids anymore, which I mean, I wouldn't want to hold a kid back, but if they're not reading at an appropriate level, then, you know, why would you pass them into high school without being able to read fluently? And I'm seeing a lot more of that as well in a lot of students.
What has your experience been like working with the families of the students? Like, how has that been?
So for me, as a Black woman working in this field, I find that the families are so appreciative to finally have somebody who looks like them supporting their child and somebody they can relate with. Like the biggest thing is, you know, understanding where they may have come from and trying to relate my instruction to things that are realistic for them, right? Like there's so many strategies out there, but they don't all apply to every child in every situation. And so for me, I'm able to kind of understand where they're coming from, what their concerns might be, and then really judge, like grade the way that I provide them information. Because sometimes if you give a family too much information, it really is demotivating. Like, I can't do that. I there's no way that I'm able to provide this support for my child. But if you really make it family specific, then you get more of a buy-in. They're more willing to listen to the strategies that you're offering and at least try. And I've had that so many times where I work with families who look like me, and they are so good at providing the support that I and resources that I share. Sorry, they're so good at providing the support and strategies that I offer them, because they trust me, they trust what I'm saying to them, and they trust it enough to try. And I've also had it the other way around, where, you know, people who don't look like me, they don't necessarily trust my judgment. And so they're not willing to try some of the strategies that I talk about. So specifically for the families who look like me, I'm so glad that I can provide them a sense of comfort and, you know, and trust. You know, I have their best interests at heart, and I would never steer them wrong.
You spoke about underrepresentation of minority students in special education. How does that work? So we had overrepresentation. So how about underrepresentation?
Right. Yeah. So in regards to underrepresentation, the factors that influence underrepresentation are pretty similar to overrepresentation. But the research also presented a few additional factors that really influence underrepresentation. And the biggest one in that area is parent factors. For some children, parents fear the stigma and discrimination that's associated with identifying a child with a disability. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, if a teacher, you know, suggests that perhaps your child would be, you know, good in a particular program and they benefit from it, the parent is saying no, because I don't want this title or this label to follow my child forever. Not knowing that actually a diagnosis gives your child more of a chance. Because if a child is not diagnosed, the school board has an excuse not to do anything.
Wow.
And that's what I always say to parents. I always say it gives them an excuse not to do anything, and really to look at your child as a behavioral child and not see them for the challenges that they face in regards to their development and their learning. Because, you know, I'm sure we can all attest to the fact that when children are, you know, struggling to learn something, their behaviors increase, right? They're walking away from the table. They're not compliant because they don't want to do it because it's too difficult, but they don't express that it's too difficult. They just, you know, present behaviors. Another factor that influence underrepresentation is the race of the student. So, and that's similar to overrepresentation. Sometimes, you know, there are biases that affect children, and some teachers will put kids in special education because they assume because of their race they're less intelligent and just put them in those programs without providing them any individualized intervention. But for underrepresentation, that's also a factor in that some teachers will provide more support for kids who look like them and ignore kids who don't look like them. And let me premise this by saying my research was primarily US data, because Canada has yet to really establish data that acknowledges this as a phenomenon. But in the States, this seems to be one of the biggest factors that influence underrepresentation of specifically Black students in special education programs to support their learning.
Why do you think there's no data from Canada? That's so interesting, eh? Like, why wouldn't we have data on this or information?
Yeah, so that was another piece of my research, because when I was researching this topic and I was looking for Canada specific information, there was nothing to be found. Wow. So I had to actually speak to individuals from the Ministry of Education, and I won't name any names, yep. But it seems like Canada is in the process of developing that data, but in the past, it wasn't seen as a phenomenon, because any complaints that went to the school board or to the Human Rights Tribunal was considered a case-by-case situation. It was not seen as a phenomenon, because one person would complain here, one person would complain over there. It wasn't a community issue. And because it wasn't a community issue, it wasn't a priority. Unlike over suspensions and expulsions of minority students, where like that is something that's like in the media, like we hear about it all the time. That's something that they focused on because it appears to be a phenomenon that is overtly seen across every school board, right? Yeah. But this disproportionality, I think one person complains here and there, and so they don't take it as a serious issue. But like I said, they are in the process of developing that resource. And I think the Toronto School Board is leading that research, and then hopefully the other boards will follow.
It's funny because, you know, when we're talking about this topic, I was thinking about people that I know that were told certain things when they're in high school, like they won't get to university or college, and they're kind of persuading them to go into like the trades, which there's nothing wrong with the trades, but they were just steering them in the wrong direction. It was like an easy out type of thing. Teachers aren't taking into consideration what the student wants or their needs of the student. So I guess that falls under the overrepresentation.
Yeah, I would also agree that is overrepresentation in those lower level courses. Like, for example, in high school, they have locally developed, applied, and academic. And locally developed does not get you to college or university. And applied gets you to college, and academic gets you to university. And if you look at those classes, because I'll just tell you, like, I was a child who took all academic courses, and I wondered to myself sometimes where all the Black kids were.
Wow.
And I was like, where
are you serious?
Black kids, like I was like one of three maybe in my class sometimes, and I wondered what happened to the rest of them. And I didn't know that, because I never took any applied courses, that they were all in applied or locally developed. So there is an overrepresentation of Black students in those lower level classes, and the pathway to those classes does not get them to university. And so coming out of elementary school, sometimes if the parents are not involved in, you know, helping them to complete their reports, or, you know, the form they fill out when they're going to high school, the teachers will do it. And again, bias will make a teacher tell a child of color to pick a lower level streamed course, locally developed or applied, right? And they're not thinking about this child's future, that, you know, once they take this class, they're not getting to university, even if they change their mind. They're just saying, oh, well, this child, you know, that's their level of ability, and they need to just go into that to just pass the course. But passing should not be the goal. The goal is your future. What does your future look like? So, I mean, there is an, I agree that there is an overrepresentation in even high school with like the types of courses that children who are minorities are put into.
I just wanted to ask you, like, your school, because you said you're one of the three Black people, Black kids in your class. Was your high school, was it pretty much, like, was it diverse?
It was extremely diverse, actually. It was like a lot of, in my elementary school, I had quite a bit of Black students in my class when I was in that school. And so when I went to high school, I wondered where they all went.
That tells me a lot.
I didn't see them again throughout high school.
Mind you, I'm just making these assumptions, but I mean, like, it's kind of what you were saying, that, you know, that kids are kind of like streamlined to go in a certain area then, right? If you're not in the know, you know, and it makes me think about, like, I mean, high school was a long time ago for me, so I can't remember, because even the terminology is different. Like, we did not have those terms. It was like advanced, general, and basic. Those are the terminology, which is horrible when you think about it. So I'm thinking maybe a lot of the students were just streamlined into like lower level classes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's why the school board has decided to de-stream certain required classes like math, English, and science, because those classes are the ones that, you know, ensure your pathway to certain secondary school post-secondary school programs, right? Mm-hmm. And so if a child going into high school is streamed into applied or locally developed English, English is a course that is required for many college level courses or many university level courses. Yeah. And so, you know, if they're put in a locally developed English class, that's it. By the time they get to grade 12 and they realize, oh my goodness, I took a locally developed English class in grade 9, I can't take any university level English classes. They have to now go back and retake English, retake math if they took, you know, a lower level math class. Like, it's not functional for children to have to do things twice, yeah, and not being, you know, told what the consequence of those choices are when they're just getting into it. Like, it's so frustrating for a grade 12 student to then have to go back to a grade 9 class and retake that.
So I'm thinking, would students actually do that? Would they actually go back and do it? Because that's a lot of work. Do you know what I mean? Like, because you already went to school, you already have completed with, I mean, it would take a lot for me to go, okay, let me start back from the beginning. I mean, if you do have goals, if, you know, if you want to change, if you want to go to university or college, yeah, but that's asking a lot from a student, no?
It is asking a lot from a student. And so that's why a lot of students don't do it. They end up just not bothering with it and going into a trade, or, which I'm not saying that, you know, post-secondary education is going to get you to like to your dream job or anything, yeah. But you know, if that was an option that you wanted to consider, you couldn't, right? And you wouldn't be willing to consider that anymore because of the excess amount of work that you would have to do, you know, at the end of your high school career when you just want to get out there and, you know, explore the world and get a job or go to post-secondary school. It's like, I don't want to have to go back and do grade 9 classes. And the other thing is, you know, teenagers have a lot of ego, and I don't know that a 17-year-old student would want to go into a that's class true. With like 13, 14-year-olds. Like, that's, you know, true. That's extremely embarrassing. You know, their peers would definitely comment on that and not make them feel good. Like, unlike us as adults, where we would say, that's so great that you're trying to, you know, achieve your goals and do whatever it takes. Kids are not like that. And so, yeah. And so, you know, that is also not a motivator for them to redo it.
What are some strategies or resources that families can research to support their child if they are in special education or
if they're looking for their child to get into special education programs?
Yeah.
One of the resources that they could access, and, you know, at the school level, would be their special education resource teacher. They have a lot of information to provide families. You just have to ask for it, right? Because a lot of schools are not offering this information freely all the time. And the other thing is, for minority families, they don't offer the information. If you don't ask for it, they're not telling you willingly. There's a lot of schools who will let parents sit there with a failing child and not give them the necessary resources. So you have to ask questions. The other part of it is, if you can access like tutoring resources, because sometimes, and I say sometimes very loosely, your child is struggling in class, and, you know, when they go to the next level of information, they have a gap in their learning. So it's not that they don't understand what's going on in the next level, is that they're missing key foundational skills to help them to comprehend that new material that's being presented. And so if you can access additional tutoring services or after-school programs that will help them to develop their foundational skills, then, you know, take advantage of it, because you don't want your child to feel like they are not intelligent if it's just they're missing some information. Like, for example, a family member of mine, I was trying to teach that person how to do fractions. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, they didn't understand how to correctly do addition and subtraction and what those symbols meant. And this is an individual who was in high school. So that illustrates a huge gap. And how do you get to high school and nobody has stopped you and said, wait, you don't know how to do addition? You don't know, you know, a subtraction or a multiplication, or like, you're asking me what this sign means and questioning, you know, when you're calculating the number in your head, you're questioning if you're right or wrong at a high school level for basic addition and subtraction questions. So then when you ask them to do a fraction question, you know, the numeracy and number sense on like skills that they should have to be able to do fractions is not there. So again, it's not the matter that they don't know how to do fractions, but all the foundational skills that you need to actually comprehend this concept is missing. So you might very well might be able to do fractions once you have that foundational skill, will all start to make sense. But until you have that knowledge, you'll never know that you can do it. Wow. And you'll feel like you're extremely behind everybody else and not, you know, and feel demotivated because like, why can they do it and I can't do it? But you're not recognizing, you know, your areas of difficulty or your gaps in knowledge. You're just seeing that you're not at the level everybody else is at.
So, okay. So that family member, I just want to get back to that. So was able to get to high school with not knowing how to like add, right? Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause that reminds me of a client that I actually had one of my previous jobs, and I was helping her look for work, and it was the same thing. And I asked her, I said, didn't anyone like show you how to do this? Cause she was at that point, she was 30 years old when she came to me. And I said, didn't anyone show you how to like, you know, to add or to give changes and that? And she's like, no. I said, your school completely failed you. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, and I see what you're saying. You have to be on top of it. The parents need to be on top of it. I'm thinking if you notice the child can't, you know, add, or maybe you should say something, you know, like say something to the parent or have a conversation with the child, with the student, absolutely. Right? Like that, it's upsetting to hear that, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely. Reading, writing, and spelling are also issues that high school students have. Spelling is, you know, it's very disappointing to see that. I mean, I know everything is like acronyms and, you know, short form now on social media, but there are so many kids in high school who cannot spell words, high frequency words that they would see all the time. They're struggling to spell those words. So, I'm so disappointed to see that their abilities are not being, like they're not being assessed and they're not being supported at the level that they need to be supported at. I think teachers are just assuming that at certain levels they should be able to do it. And, you know, they actually don't have time to go back and teach phonological awareness or phonics or reading and writing strategies. They don't have time for that. Right. And then again, the school board just keep pushing them through until they get to college, university level. And they're still struggling at those levels with reading and writing. And that's a thing that the school board has done, is they have tried to accommodate children who come from environments that, you know, they would not maybe have the same education level as a child who both parents, you know, did a post-secondary degree, or they come from a higher socioeconomic status community and they have more access to resources. They've kind of made the grading system more equitable, that teachers are not penalizing kids as severely for grammar and spelling errors, because they recognize that these kids may not have the same reading and writing levels as kids who, again, have access to resources.
Okay.
But at the same time, I'm not rewarding you for incorrect grammar. You need to at some point learn, right? But if we keep ignoring it, how do they learn? And so that's where I kind of disagree with the system. But then I also agree with it at the same time, because you don't want to be too heavy-handed with them when you know that there are issues. But then where is the intervention to, again, close the gap in their learning. We don't just accept that that's just how they are and what they're going to be able to do. We need to provide intervention. And I don't think schools are doing enough of that.
So, okay, so that's kind of like a hot topic, the schools, because I mean, you know, like they're in the online, right? Well, they're not actually online now, but just due to the pandemic, you know, and the way the education is moving in the sense that, okay, so they were out of school a lot last year. So they were in school this year, but they were like, they're off for a couple of weeks. How is the online environment affecting students in special education?
Yeah, so I don't think it's affecting them positively. For some students who have a significant need, the school system has actually allowed them to remain in school because obviously like virtual learning is going to be so unproductive. But for children who are in typically developing classes and don't have behaviors and, you know, they need just some support, but not a significant amount that, you know, prevents them from being virtual, it still has not been positive or beneficial because there isn't enough support and you're expecting parents to teach their child at school without the adequate resources that the school might potentially provide them or, you know, the additional support or strategies that teachers and educational assistants and the special education resource teacher have, you know, in their tool belt. They're expecting parents to do that at home. And that alone is difficult, not even including the fact that the child is home in their comfortable environment having to learn. That creates so many behaviors in itself, right? So I don't think the schools really consider that environment plays a role in these kids being able to attend to the material that's presented. But in terms of learning, I think that at this point, because we've been in the pandemic so long, teachers either know how to support their child with special needs on the computer, or they kind of just leave them to their own devices. Like they're just like, they're not learning. I'm not going to go overboard because, you know, eventually they'll be back in school where they can provide the support again. So some teachers are just not putting in a sufficient amount of effort to accommodate or modify the material for kids virtually. They're just giving them the same material as everybody else and expecting that they'll pick up on it.
And I just wanted to, sorry, I guess I just wanted to say, okay, we're not knocking teachers because
we're not knocking teachers by any means. I'm not a teacher. Yeah. And obviously I don't know what it's like to be in a classroom setting, but I'm speaking from the perspective of a tutor who has worked with quite a few kids who are currently doing virtual learning and children who require special support and modifications to their work. And it is not adequate. And I'm sure they can agree. And it's not based on their ability to teach, but again, it's, you know, the resources that are available, you know, what exactly can they do? They're not in the child's home. They can't sit with them side by side. And the material is not 100% engaging. So there's only so much you can do on the computer before you lose them. So, I understand the difficulty that they do have. But in regards to the question of, you know, how does it impact students? How does e-learning impact students? That's how it impacts them. They're not learning. They're not really, you know, getting further in their education. It's more so just trying to regulate their behavior to get them to sit in front of the computer and maybe engage in something for 10 minutes and then give them a break. That's all they can do really, right?
I know as an adult, e-learning is hard for me. Like I know that I'm the kind of person that needs to be in school, right? Like, I mean, I would need someone to like say, this is what you do. Give me examples. I need to hear it, right? So I can imagine what it's like for a child to be at home. I remember a couple years ago, I was trying to help my nephew. He was here and he was going to school and I'm just like, it was so hard. And he was only in grade 4. And I'm like, why is this so difficult? I cannot help him with math. Math was so hard because he wasn't getting it. I couldn't explain it at his level. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it was just like, I had to get into that mindset and it was really, really, really difficult. So,
Right. And so from the perspective of a parent or a caregiver of a child, that's probably how they're all feeling, right? Like, you know, they're not the teacher who's been going over the same material over and over again. As an adult, now you have to think back, how did I learn this material? Like, how do I simplify it to the point where my 4-year-old, 5-year-old will be able to learn it and not use like adult terminology to describe, you know, this concept. And so that's what I'm talking about, like the tools and tricks that teachers have. Parents might not be aware of it. And then again, the environment, right? Some kids need to learn in a particularly structured environment for learning. School is not to play video games, not to sleep. You know, they know that when they go to school, they're learning versus when they're at home, that's their place of refuge. You know, they take a break, they sleep, they eat, they play video games. And to now have to combine the education and, you know, your time of peace, it's difficult for kids because they, you know, they don't know how to differentiate between school and home now. And really, they just want to relax. So their engagement, you know, decreases quite a bit. So, you know, for parents out there who are struggling with kids doing virtual learning, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself, because this is the situation that you're put into. You really can't do anything more than what's given to you right now. And, you know, you just have to get your child through virtual learning, and then, you know, now they're back in school, which is awesome. So hopefully, you know, they don't have to go back online, at least until next year, if this happens again.
Just to wrap this up, what can parents do to be informed of their children's education? Like, I mean, you gave us some points, but I just want to just kind of reiterate that for the parents out there who see, and I don't want to use the word issues, but have concerns about their child's education. What are some resources?
Be in constant contact with your child's teacher. You know, they, like I said previously, they will share enough information, but they won't share an excess amount. If you ask for more information, they will tell you more. But, you know, teachers are, they have a lot of students to work with, and they're not going to call every parent every second to tell them everything that's going on with their child.
That's true.
If you find that your child is struggling in school, you need to take the initiative to ask the teacher, hey, can you tell me more about like where they're struggling? What areas do we need to keep working on at home? How can we support our child? What strategies do you have that we can use at home? The other thing is, and I didn't really get to talk much about it, but there is an IEP, which stands for an individual education plan, that some kids get because of their learning difficulties, or if they have a diagnosis of some developmental disorder that impacts their learning, they get this document that states how they're supposed to be supported in the school system, whether their learning needs are accommodated or modified. So they're getting modified curriculum, or they're getting alternative curriculum because they can't manage the current level of material that's presented to them. Parents need to be involved in those meetings. They need to read it thoroughly. And they also need to ask questions about, like, so is this being implemented in the classroom? How is it being implemented in the classroom? If it's not, if you find that, you know, your child has an IEP and they're still struggling or at the same level, you know, is there a way to modify the IEP? One thing parents might not know is the IEP is a legal document. So anything on an IEP needs to be fulfilled. Otherwise, the school board and the school are not fulfilling their end of this contract. And so I always tell parents, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but I tell them to not sign it until they understand everything that is on that document. Because once you sign it, of course you can modify it at any point, but, you know, it's a document that you can use to hold the school and the teachers accountable for the support that your child is receiving. And so if you sign it without understanding what's on there, you can't hold anybody accountable because you don't know what your child is supposed to have. So do your research and ask questions, and talk to the administration if you need to. If you find that, you know, teachers are not supporting your child the way that they need to be supported, or if the administration doesn't help, you know, go to the ministry, not ministry, the school board. And then after the school board, the Ministry of Education, like, you know, reach out to, you know, different academic avenues to make sure that your child is getting what they need, right? It's not something that you want, but it's what they need to be successful in school, because really, you know, they're going to be in school for years, and you don't want, like I spoke about gaps in their learning, you don't want this gap to continue into high school, because actually after grade three, the gap in the material learning grade three to grade four is so wide that even just there, your child can be behind so many levels and is struggling to keep up all the way until high school. So you have to be on it as early as possible.
Oh yeah. From grade three? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. The level of difficulty between grade one, two, and three, it's kind of on par. Like you just, you know, it's a step up. But once you go from grade three to grade four, there is a big gap in the learning that you did in grade one, two, and three, and then the new material that you learn in grade four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Wow. So, and that's why it's so important for kids to know how to read at least at grade three level, because after that, you know, the material math becomes more about word problems and application and not about what's 1 + 1, 2 + 2. Like it changes so much the material that your kids get. So they need those foundational skills in the first three grade levels. I always offer strategies and resources to families, but I highly believe that every child is unique and individual. And so the strategies and the resources that I would suggest for one child would differ from child to child. So if you did have any specific questions about your particular child, you can definitely reach out to me at my email, which is tiffanya92@gmail.com. And I will gladly answer any questions that you have about any of the material I presented today, as well as specific questions about your child. And again, I premise that I'm not a teacher, but I have worked with children who have learning and developmental disabilities, and you know, have a lot of strategies that I pull out here and there when I'm working with these kids. And so I would be happy to help you in any way that I could.
So thanks a lot for being part of the show and for answering the questions with regards to the impact of education on minority students. Thank you for providing some of the information about your paper. So thanks a lot.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
Thanks for joining me for the latest episode of Words of Michelle, the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, I'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you have any questions or would like to provide feedback, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can email me at michelle@wordsofmichelle.com. You can also email me if you have inquiries regarding sponsoring the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, bye.